So the agent now gets to double their commission because they're listing a property $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 higher. In the last case that I had on my latest one, it was for $2.1 million. She was getting offers at $1.9 million. The agent came to me. Now we're selling it for $2.85 million. That commission is huge.
How does the average profit from a novation deal compare to other types of real estate transactions?
Oh, money, man. So...
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth. Today, we are joined by Trevor Ahing, the founder of the nation's largest novation-based dispositions company. Trevor specializes in resuscitating dead deals into profitable ventures for wholesalers, agents, and traditional investors. In 2023 alone, his company facilitated over $1 million in profit from these deals for their community. And he's got plans to double that figure in 2024. Trevor, welcome.
What's going on, man? I appreciate you having me.
You bet. Glad to have you on today, man.
Of course. Of course. It's a good Thursday. I feel good. I had a great team training. I got the whole team down here every Thursday. So getting a packed house always keeps my energy high, man.
I saw that on your social. What's the team training? Tell me about this.
With creative, you can dive so deep into the nuances of it. This is kind of to reel us back, get back to the basics, reverse engineer where we want to be for the quarter and just reinvigorate each other, right? Get in front of it, Create that synergy. So it's funny, you know, how you dive so deep into, rabbit holes, but to kind of go back to just the basics, you always find something new every single time. Yeah. So to do that with the team is great.
That's great. So, Trevor, you were a Marine. First of all, I want to say thank you.
Once a Marine, always a Marine, man.
Yeah, that is true. First of all, thank you for your service. I appreciate your contribution.
Thank you for your support.
You bet. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about how you began your real estate investment journey at the same time that you were deploying into the Middle East?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I'm an 8-year Marine, right? I was an E6. So I picked up, six ranks in under 6 years. So I drank that Kool-Aid hard, man. I was going to do 30 years in the Marines. I absolutely still to this day love the Marine Corps. I rep it all the time. You know, I wouldn't be the man I am without the structure and my time in the service. But it's a good story and a sad story. You know, I started getting into real estate through the VA loan, right? And financial literacy is not taught amongst service members, you know? So it's really like you got buddies who are pulling out $5,000 loans to get a necklace, you know what I mean? Or chains. And it's just unfortunate because you're working hard to just play harder, especially when you're in the suck a lot of the time in the Marines. So coming into it, I started delving into some real estate stuff just because I heard of house hacking through Brandon Turner, Bigger Pockets, you know? And I was like, okay, so if I get a house that's too big for me and I can rent out the other rooms of my buddies, I told my wife, I said, hey, babe, I think that if we wanted to start doing what's called cash flow, we can have some of our buddies stay in there with the basic allowance for housing that they get. Because the Marine Corps gives you a stipend to live, you know, off base once you pick up a certain rank. So I did that, got my first house, started doing that with all my buddies, realized that I could start building, you know, wealth through cash flow, wasn't even looking at anything, outside of that. I went to do that my second time, and my father-in-law, who's been my number one supporter, you know, he came to that house, and it was like a madhouse, dude. I was renting out my living room with a bed. I had two to a room. I mean, it was like gross. You know, I just got captivated by what the possibilities could be, and all my buddies didn't care because they're in the Marines, you know, so they got to save a bunch on their rent by bunking up with their friends. But my wife, as the only female, was like, look, I'm kind of over this. You know what I mean? But she was such a trooper. So my father-in-law came in and it was a holiday and he looked around and he goes, hey, I love the hustle, but my daughter deserves so much better than this. You know? And I said, you know what? He goes, just promise me it's not forever. So I said, okay. I ended up deploying. And as I was going to deploy, he ended up passing with an aneurysm suddenly. Right. So he had died and my wife took it horrible. That was the first death she's ever had. I took it horrible and I didn't feel like I was fit to deploy. I needed to be here for my family. And unfortunately, the Marine Corps was, you know, it's a thankless service. It's a revolving door. They said, no, you know, you got to go. And so during my wife's, you know, most emotional time in her life, in our life, I had to be gone for 6 months in the Middle East, and I just felt as if I'm doing so much to provide for my family in the Marines that the one time I really needed to, I couldn't be there. And I just told myself, I'm never going to allow anything to take my time away, you know, from me on what's important. And so I saw what real estate was already doing for me, and I just dived directly into there, and I started looking at different approaches, and I settled on some creative approaches, and I never looked back, and I got out of the Marine Corps, and that was back in 2021, and I've been doing real estate for, you know, about 4 years since, and it's been great, you know. So that's like a long-winded story of how I really got into it, but why I seriously, you know, why I decided to take it seriously.
No, I love that story. That's great. I mean, it is a sad story, but it is powerful, and it gives a definite clear purpose to what you're seeking here. You already kind of shared this, but you know, what challenges did you face when you were starting that journey while deployed in the Middle East, and how did you overcome them? Is there anything else that really kind of stood out to you during that time?
Yeah, man. So it's what strategy you're going to go to, right? I mean, nursing real wealth, like identifying where you want to build wealth. There's getting rich and there's building wealth. You know, I didn't know the difference. So I was like, you know, I'm going to go. And so when I was deployed, I said, I'm going to get all my hours for becoming an agent. I'm going to become the new Ryan Serhant of the era. I'm going to become the biggest luxury agent. You know, I'm going to do that. So as I started diving into that, then come to find out there's something called assignment real estate. There's wholesale. Then you start, you know, it's always the shiny object syndrome. So that was huge because all I had was time, you know, and nothing but it, because it was during COVID. So it was like I was deploying, providing security, and then just on a makeshift laptop trying to research real estate. And Google just had 100 ways to get rich, you know. So I was trying to dive into every single one of those. And luckily, I ended up stumbling with just getting my license in wholesale, which ended up transitioning me into the gap of creative. And that's kind of how I found that.
That's great. In what ways, if any, do you think that your military background shaped your leadership style that you're needing for your business?
What a question, man. I can be a little drill instructor sometimes. You know, I can definitely see it. My employees and my team always, you know, can get on me sometimes. I would say it's shaped it by identifying snowballs instead of avalanches, right? You have to be very proactive instead of reactive. You know what I mean? Same with fighting forces, same with anything that we do. It's also the same when it comes down to building a business. So I'm always going to make, you know, a bigger deal about certain things to allow that to trickle into the importance, because my team will know what to do, but I want them to know why they do it. And so I dive really deep in kind of understanding, you know, the why behind the how or the what. And so the Marine Corps really taught me that. And then as well as the structure, you know, so I can be very rigid. I think we have a great battle rhythm. I've identified, you know, what days we do what. And so once you kind of get into that kind of mindset and you can see the importance behind it, that can funnel into great synergy, which creates really good exponential growth. And so once you see what your left and right lateral limits are, and you get really good at that, instead of going wide, you just go deep with that. We really rely on each other throughout the entire team. And so everybody really has a job and a purpose. And I think the Marine Corps also helped me with that as well.
That's great. Obviously, you didn't start out with a team, I'm sure, right?
No.
Yeah. So what did Trevor's beginnings look like?
Oh, my humble beginnings, man. Mine was a $5,000 wholesale mentorship on a credit card, you know, and diving into that, which I got lucky, Justin. I got lucky because that translated into great wealth and one of my best friends now. We've done multiple deals since then. He actually just, you know, he's currently lending on some of my opportunities. So I came into that. I didn't do any research behind him, no due diligence. I was like, this dude's on social media. He's got the proof. Here you go. And I do not recommend that, of course, right? But coming into that, my first attempt into getting in front of deals was cold callers, because I still was in the Marine Corps. I did this for about a year and a half, still in the service. So I would come home and I had a VA who would call our lists of high equity, absentee owners, pre-foreclosures, and I would come in front of 2 to 3 opportunities a night, and I would just go deep on those. I would call them, and I just did that, just getting turned down, becoming numb to the no, until finally about 7 months in, I got my first yes. And I've always, for my first 3 deals, just reinvested into it, which was tough not to, man. You know, you start making a little bit of money. You know, I was almost going back to the rat race with my buddies, but I had the right kind of audience. I had the right kind of people behind me, and my wife always kept my head on in a way where we're looking at the longevity, right? I was looking at the light at the end of the tunnel, not the tunnel itself. And so I got lucky in regards to that. So I would say it was just me until I made my first six figures. And then it was, okay, now I need somebody who's going to be able to be my acquisitions, which kind of started delving into building slowly but surely, you know, a team of 11.
It took you 7 months to get your first deal. Was there ever a point at which you were like, dang, this is a long haul, and maybe this is the wrong thing?
Yeah. I would say probably every night, right? You know, like as you come into it, it's always just, you know, the grass is always greener. So I'm like, I picked the wrong thing. You know, I'm doing the wrong, you know, I'm saying the wrong things. I picked the wrong, you know, approach, yada, yada. But really, you know, believing in myself, you know, it was something that I wasn't good at first. You know who was good at it? The emotional reassurance that came from my initial success in real estate was my wife, dude. Like, she just solely was like, you put your mind to things and you accomplish it. Look what you've done. Like, I'm here. Let's do it. If this is what you want to do, and she saw how hard I worked, she goes, you're right around the corner. And so as we got into it, my first deal was $6,000. And it was the biggest win. She treated it, and I probably spent double that on marketing, you know what I mean? But she treated it as if it was, we're millionaires, and just seeing what could become because of that kind of support. I've never looked back with her. And so to go more into that, we got that. And then it's funny because as the gratitude starts coming in and you start having that self-belief as well, and you start diving into it a little deeper, I got my second deal, and my second deal was $150,000. So I went from, you know, that to this. And then I told myself, I'm like, this is easy. You know, we're rich, which it's not easy. You know what I mean? And we're not rich. So going into it some more, I reinvested a lot of that into systems because I was really failing forward. I wasn't really tracking my KPIs. You know, it wasn't ever my fault. It was a seller's fault because they didn't want to move forward with me. And so you start identifying, you know, other approaches, and I started, you know, adding more tools to my tool belt. And that's when I started leaning creative and the on-market approach. And then I was able to bleed the two through, you know, the hard work I got from a deal.
Well, I think that's a really great takeaway for anybody who's listening, because, you know, obviously the majority of the folks I'm trying to encourage right here are people who are in their 9-to-5. They're people who are maybe looking for maybe an exit or even just a supplement to their income. And the reality is, as you pursue that, you may find that it takes you a really, really long time to get started. Man. But that doesn't mean that you give up, you know. You know, Trevor's a good testament to that.
I appreciate it. I say it all the time. People that want to call for me in my DMs, I'm like, why? Because I want to get in front of money. Okay. How long could I have you? Could I have you dialing every day for 30 days? Oh, absolutely. Can I have you dialing every day for 60 days? Probably. Can I have you dialing every day for 90 days? I don't think I can do that. Then real estate's not your industry. Real estate is not your industry, man. You know what I mean? You got to get a shovel and you got to see if you're going to strike gold yourself. And that's on you. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I agree completely. It's not a get rich quick thing, but once you're able to build that funnel, you just never look back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love it. Well, let's dive into your niche. You do novations. So tell us about novations. What are they? How are they different than a normal real estate transaction?
All right, Justin, man, let's do it. So yes. And for first time listeners or people that do know novations, you know, I do them a bit differently too, right? Novations are a replacement of one's position through the conventional lending terms of the on-market approach. All that means, it's a fancy way of saying it's just wholesale, but on market. Right? Instead of targeting an off-market cash buyer to replace your position, I'm finding a conventional third-party purchaser who's got a VA, FHA, all cash, conventional. They're coming in here to replace my position because I collaborated with the homeowner to get this property sold through the multiple listing service, right? So there's two approaches with novations, right? You can do one where it's kind of a net listing approach, which just means the homeowner wants a certain amount, right? You can guarantee them that amount. You can take care of the marketing, maintenance, and management behind that. Throw that bad boy on the market with an agent. You get somebody who wants to come in and get it, you know, at a certain price above what the seller wants. Once they purchase it, we take care of the realtor fees and closing costs. Whatever's left over above what the seller wanted is a return on our investment, or it's our fee. So we can build our fee through the optimism of the market. That's why I like novations. But there's also a downturn because the seller wants a little bit too much. Unfortunately, we don't have the right offer. We're eating into their bottom line. and we're not going to make anything, right? So it's a double-edged sword sometimes. So knowing your numbers is crucial, but that is, in a nutshell, what novations are, and then you can go on to the nuance of the different types of novations.
Gotcha. Okay. So I have a feeling that there's going to be some people who listen to that and they're like, whoa, he just went into like,
outer space.
Like he went into like rocket science, talk. If there's a very simple, simplistic explanation of a novation, if you could draw a similarity to something else, what would it be?
I got you. So you're still, and I want to preface that novations, and you got to probably have a baseline of what wholesale is for listeners, right? You do. Because the demographic, my audience of novations is the same as wholesalers. You're targeting what we call the four Ds: death, distress, divorce, and debt, right? So these sellers are in a situation, and unfortunately, you're coming in, you're building rapport with these homeowners. They like you. You're trying to give them the wholesale offer. And then when you give them that all cash offer that's very low, they say, go kick rocks. That's way too low. I need, let's say, $30,000 more, $50,000 more. That is the baseline for a perfect novation. Because what you let them know, you say, you know what? That might be outside of my buy box, you know, your price that you want, but I do have great news. You know, I could get you that price now, but I'm going to have to focus on what we do on terms. If I can guarantee you that price, would you be open to my terms? And the seller goes, yeah. They go, great. Okay. You want this certain amount. Right. I do think I pride myself in my marketing capabilities. If I can focus on finding somebody off market or on market, let's even say we get somebody to come in and purchase your home through the on market, you know, approach, I'll pay for all your fees. Right. I'll pay for your realtor fees, your closing costs, because I know that's why you don't want to go on market. And let's say anything left over for me to build the bridge between your price and what we could sell it for is going to be what I take away for my marketing fee. Right. But I'm only going to be able to accept offers that you're going to walk away with your bottom line. You know, do you think we can work together on that? And so if the seller says yes, right, and I'm going to use quick numbers, Justin, I love this example. If a property is worth $500,000 fully renovated, it's actually probably going to be a little bit better. If the property is worth $500,000 fully renovated, you know, and it needs $50,000 worth of work, a typical wholesale fee in order to make just 15, 20 grand, you're coming at 70 cents on the dollar minus your rehab, minus your fee. You're offering that home, that homeowner, about $280,000 to $300,000, right? In order to be able to assign it. If that seller does not like that offer and they say, I need at least $350,000, that's just a dead wholesale deal. You know, there you can't do anything with that unless you say, you know what? What if I do give you $350,000, right? And then I focus on the marketing, maintenance, and management behind your home. Right. I'm going to take this. I'm going to test the on-market approach. I have top 1% agents in the area, but I'm going to pay for all the fees associated. So if you do so and the seller likes that, let's say you put it on market. You can't put it on market for 500 because it needs 50K worth of work. But you could probably put it on market for 445, right? Because your audience for your buyer is somebody who's usually a first-time home buyer, VA, FHA buyer, where they like the area. They can't afford these beautiful big houses, right? But they do like the fact that they can build sweat equity in your home. So you're just targeting that buyer. So when they walk that home, they go, I mean, the carpet's kind of ugly and, you know, the paint's chipping, you know, but honey, we can do the floors ourselves, right? We can do this over the next year. We can help fix this thing up. You know, you then get an offer at 445. After the realtor fees and closing costs that you're responsible for, you're at about I'd say 415. The seller wanted 350. On that dead wholesale deal, you just ended up making $50,000 to $60,000 as a novation fee by building the gap between what the seller wanted and bringing them somebody who's actually going to be able to pay top dollar. And your fee gets paid by the buyer. Nothing comes out of the seller's bottom line. They get that amount guaranteed.
Cool. Now that scenario that you just described was more of a non-rehab scenario, right?
Yeah. We call that our equity protection program. That's one scenario.
Love it. Okay, cool. Walk us through a scenario where there's construction involved and how does that work?
Dope. Okay, so that's my bread and butter, right? So that's what Buyer Beater focuses on. Because if you find a deal, we'll fund the entire renovation. So that same numbers, okay? It's worth 500. It needs 50K worth of rehab. You go for 280. Seller goes, Justin, that's way too low. I need 350. What I usually have my team go, I go, you got to tell the seller you're solution oriented. This is still the equity protection approach. This is what we were discussing before. You go, you know what, Brenda? I knew it was going to be too low. That's why I already took the liberty and I approved you for our equity protection model, right? We're going to come in there. That whole spiel about not doing any renovation, we're just trying to target current condition retail value, not after repair value. I'll get into that in a little bit. Current condition retail value is just, what could I throw this thing up there for if I put, you know, a grand or two grand into it to clean this bad boy up? That's that 445 mark. Now, if we have that already, you know, brushed aside, because that's usually for if the homeowner, it lives in it. That's for owner occupied, because you're not going to fully renovate a home that the owner lives in. I've done two of those, made a lot of money with the biggest headaches I've ever had in my entire life. So I never do that again. But same numbers. And if the property is vacant and it's worth $500,000 and needs 50K worth of work, you're coming in at 280. Seller goes, I just evicted my tenants. You know, like I know that this house is worth more. I don't have the money to be able to renovate it. There's got to be another way. There is. You know, if you want $350,000, let's guarantee that. I'm going to come in there. Let's collaborate. You know, how about I fund the entire renovation, right? I'm going to make this thing 2024 turnkey with my own contractors, and I'm going to put this on the market with my top 1% agents. Any appreciation I create through the renovation that I take the risk for, I'm going to take as my fee. So if I sell it at 500, right, and I pay for everything, and after your realtor fees and closing costs, there's going to be some left over. That's going to be whatever amount I get above your 350 guaranteed. And usually that would bake in, if you sell it for five, after realtor fees and closing costs, you know, you're at about 465. You know, they want 350, you put in 50, that's a $65,000 difference. So your $50,000 just made over 100% cash on cash. You gave the seller 70,000 more that they wanted. You both walk away very, very happy. And I do these nationwide and the sellers love them, dude. They love them. They feel like they're a part of a flip show. You know what I mean? I work them into it and it's just so cool to see.
That's awesome. You ever thought about creating a flip show?
Oh my God. My videographer tells me all the time. We have all these testimonies. We do it, dude. We actually do stuff like that. We'll walk it. And it's just the sellers are pretty shy on camera. You know what I mean? Sure. So you have to like prep that a lot more. But yeah. I've tried with the champagne. I'm like, hey, and they're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, dang. Maybe I shouldn't.
All right. When in your experience, what are the key factors to consider when determining if a wholesale lead is really a good candidate for innovation? Because I'm assuming not every deal that a seller wants more than what's being offered is always going to check out as an ovation.
Yeah. Even the wholesalers think that all the time. If you just put a basketball court in the backyard and added a third story, it could be worth so much more. I'm like, no, man, no, but that's a good question, right? You're going to have to identify the spread. We have a novation calculator in the community and just, we have two formulas as well that we end up going, you know, going on that's going to kind of put you in the right mindset to be able to offer innovation. But it's simpler than that. You know, if you know that, you know, they want within or around that wholesale amount, they just deserve or want a little bit more, and you feel as if up to $5,000 if they live in the home is going to be able to get this into a position that can create good curb appeal, there's probably good optimism to be able to put this on the market. Now, the biggest thing is, even if that's $15,000 or $60,000, right? The market's going to dictate your price. What I tend to find out is we get roughly 40 to 50 submissions a week, right? To be able to utilize this. And we say no more often than yes, just because the homeowner needs to want us, right? The novation model means that we don't close quick, right? Our average time on market's between 72 to 120 days to include our 21-day inspection, right? To include our renovations of whatever we do, to include marketing and then put on market and then escrow. We're not a 21-day close wholesale, right? So if you want a cash offer, you take, you know, if you want to close in 21 days, you take the cash offer. If you want a higher amount, then I can work you into your profit through a longer period, right? You can't have your cake and eat it too. So it's really identifying sellers that are open, ready, willing, and able to want to work with you. And it needs to be expressed correctly because creative is scary, right? If you come across incorrect with a seller, and you just start using all these terms that I just used on you for investors, it's going to turn them off. They're like, what do you mean? If you go, yeah, we're going to force appreciate your property and you're going to do a seller finance carry, it's like, what? Right? You just need to be able to break it down in a way where the homeowner understands the benefit of working with you, because you're just a service. You know, creative real estate, in my eyes, is just complimentary real estate. Hey, you're in a situation, Mr. Seller, you want a little bit more than what it's worth through cash. Why don't we come in there and why don't I help you through my marketing, maintenance, and management of your home? I'll put some risk into it. We're going to work together and let's get the profit that we both deserve. If they feel as if that's a good service for them, then we're very transparent about what we can make, because we're getting them that price by working them into their equity. So identifying a good seller is actually harder than identifying a good deal, because it needs to be expressed correctly.
Sure. Gotcha. All right. And then, you know, what components about the deal are you looking at that are going to determine whether or not that's going to be an adequate? I believe when we were talking, you said something along, you aim for a specific cash on cash return. So you obviously have to know your after repair and everything and your rehab budget. So yeah, tell us about that.
That's a good question, man. So we have a couple things, right? If we're going to put in money on these properties, right, you know, we'll go nationwide, but I will say we're not going to be, you know, in the middle of the forest in somewhere where it's, you know, no other comparables are, you know what I mean? We're going to be roughly in or around cities. You know, we like to have, you know, time on market between 28 days or less. And then we want to make sure we make a minimum of 75% cash on cash. What I mean by that is if we're going to put, you know, $50,000 into it, we got to make roughly $35,000 gross. That's gross. You know, just make sure there's a spread, because we're creating equity in the home. The market does take a turn. I got to make sure we can at least get our position back, right? Because we can control the sale. But usually if we do a 10% correction, we're still able to make about a 40 to 50%, you know, return on our investment, which is still great. You know, so we really kind of aim higher because we can work the seller into an optimistic approach. So yeah, 75% cash on cash in or around cities and collaborative seller and days on market, roughly 28 days or less.
Awesome. And when you look at your company's track record, how does the average profit from a novation deal compare to other types of real estate transactions?
Oh, money, man. So if you're going to look at, let's say, a traditional wholesale, this is why I like this question, because I really cater to agents and then I cater to wholesalers, because if it's a wholesale deal, you should do the wholesale deal. You know what I mean? Like that's money right there. If you got somebody ready to go, you're good. Don't try to change it up on your seller. But if it's just right above that buy box and we come into it, our average wholesale fee that we've seen last year on the equity protection is $38,000. Our lowest was $17,000, right? Our average equity split is $72,000. Our highest was $267,000, right? So you're able to really come into some great profit because you're collaborating with your homeowner. And the best thing is with fix and flippers too, we have a lot of fix and flippers who prefer this model now, because when you work with homeowners and they're carrying that note, they're carrying a 2.8 or a 3.5 or something. And usually if your biggest rebuttal is they go, Trev, I love this, but I don't want to wait 4 months. I mean, I have to pay a mortgage for 4 months. No, I just say, hey, you know what? What is your mortgage? And they tell me $2,600. I say, I'll pay you $2,800. I'm going to pay your mortgage. I'm going to cash flow you every month until this property sells. And I do that because A, that's a whole hell of a lot cheaper than interest only payments. You know what I mean? It's amazing. B, I don't have to put 20% down or 10% in a bank. I have no point origination fees, right? I don't have to get bank backed, credit checked. I just get to, now, if I am in agreement with the homeowner tomorrow, my team can come in there and renovate it. I don't have to wait to close. There's no escrow period. There's no upfront closing costs. It is so much easier, you know, to be able to spread your wealth or your funding and diversify that into two or three projects instead of piling that into one cookie jar. And so that's what I love about that on that approach. And then for the agents, right, when it comes down to listing homes on market, we have agents who send us deals all the time. If they go to a listing appointment and they're looking around and they're like, damn, if this thing had $30,000 more, it could be worth another 70. I'm that $30,000 more. You know, when that agent goes to that home, they go, you know what, Mrs. Seller, like we could put this on market. I know it's going to need some work. I just want to let you know it could sit for roughly 45, 60 days. I also work with a creative financing company where they'll come in, they'll just fund the entire renovation behind this. That bottom line that you want to list this for, they're going to guarantee that to you. Anything above that, they're going to pay for my realtor fees and your closing costs, and they're going to get a return on their investment. So the agent now gets to double their commission because they're listing a property $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 higher. In the last case that I had on my latest one, it was for $2.1 million. She was getting offers at $1.9 million. The agent came to me. Now we're selling it for $2.85 million. That commission is huge, you know? And so she's ecstatic. The seller got $200,000 more and we're donating $10,000 to their church. So the agent fiduciary is not only to the seller, but it's to their pockets. They get to make their seller more, and then they get to list the property that's going to be turnkey. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be in their portfolio of something that they're proud of. And they're going to actually find other, you know, people that want to sell in that same condition because they found themselves as a credible agent listing these homes already. So it truly is a win-win-win. So I get to come at it from both angles and kind of, you know, build or merge our worlds, which usually agents kind of have a sore, you know, taste in their mouth for wholesalers, but now they get to kind of work together to utilize me. And it's kind of cool to be able to build that, you know, build that bridge.
That's great.
That was a lot, yeah, man. I know. I'm so passionate about this stuff, dude.
Yeah, no, I really love that. You know, cause you're able to work both sides of the field pretty well. It's a win-win for wholesalers and for agents.
It is.
Yeah. Awesome. So, obviously in order to get into a deal, you got to have a process of due diligence that you guys are going through. What is the process of due diligence that your company performs to ensure that each Novation deal really aligns with your targeted profit margins?
It's a good question.
What do you got to work through?
Yeah. Like I would say, I mean, the equity split approach, even if we don't move forward, we still actually, you know, we still fish out, you know, a good amount of money. We have a full home inspection on our properties within 21 days. We're not going to have anything pop up when we're, you know, under renovation. We have to make sure our budget fits our scope of work that we initially created. We pull a preliminary title report. We have to make sure there's nothing else on the property that's going to encumber it at all. I need to make sure that we're good to go on whatever we have to pay out with that. Homeowner is transparent. You'd be surprised. Buyers are liars. Sellers are worse, right? They'll come in front of, you know, they'll come in front of a lot of things they're not going to tell you. We do between 2 to 3 different CMAs with a couple other, you know, agents locally. I always use local agents. I don't do flat fee listing services. I do think you pay good money to agents who are professional in that area. They're going to be able to negotiate better on your behalf and you're going to sell it a lot quicker. I'm okay spending money doing that. And so they're usually very honest. And they know the process. We go, hey, you're not going to list it in this condition. We're renovating it for you, right? What do you think you could sell it for, you know, when it comes down to it? And I want to know top dollar. And I want to know, hey, if I want to move this thing in 10 days, you know, where is that going to be as well? So we come in front of, we're very proactive with where it's going to be. And then usually we end up having my project manager, you know, get in front of an agent's contractor and then our own contractor. And then we identify our scope of work. And all that is within 21 days. It usually takes about 15 days to be able to find all that out. We go back to the homeowner, we let them know, and then we're off to the races, man. For the equity protection, look, as much as I want to sit here and say both, the equity split where we put money into it, it's a very quality over quantity, right? We don't do too many, right? But we still make sure that when we do them, it's going to be a home run. The equity protection, there's nothing wrong with testing the market. That's quantity over quality, right? We know where the homeowner wants. So if we can just try to be optimistic about it, I usually, not everybody does this, right? I have a lot of friends who do novations, they don't, but I fund up to $5,000 of renovations in the equity protections just to ensure we can, you know, deep clean the home, paint the fascia, finish the landscaping, just put this in a curb appeal status to where when it comes on market, there is some attraction behind it. And I had three that didn't close last year, only three. And so we lost about 15 grand, but our average, you know, fee is double that. So I'm okay being able to take that risk, you know? So identifying that, I like to put them on the market and it's actually really good for renegotiation. When the seller sees that we're really trying to be able to get this thing sold and they see the offers that are coming in, we either renegotiate and say, hey, look, we have someone ready to go. We just got to get you right here. And you can see where the market dictates. I'm not the bad guy. We're testing all of our, you know, our avenues. They're usually a lot more open to drop the price or they just go, no, you know what I mean? So my whole pitch with equity protection is, look, give us 90 days. Let me put $5,000 or so into your home. Let me spruce this bad boy up. Let me take some professional photos. Let me test exactly where your market is. If we don't sell it, You don't got to pay us back. Now you got an updated home. You got beautiful photos. You can see what you can really sell it for, and you can fire us, right? And they always chuckle, and they're like, okay, right? It's people do business with people. So a lot of them do end up extending it out, and it's a lot easier to take price reductions and work to a close with that.
Yeah. So you obviously you do the two different types where you get the equity protection, but then you also do renovations. Yep. About how many of each of those would you say you do each year?
Last year was 76, right? 76. We did about 23 that was with funding, right? So I think altogether it was a little over $680,000 that we used for renovations. You know, we've grown from four lenders, you know, to, you know, over 31, just all private monies, all different walks of life. And I know you're a great expert when it comes down to that. So we've had some good talks in regards to getting in front of the right capital use. Now, turning that over on this year, we're looking at doubling it, you know, but, you know, with that being said, we are more picky, right? We were before. I mean, we were like, what, 80, 20, 75, 35 or 75, 25 of equity splits to equity protections. We're probably going to want to be somewhere around 60-40, but when we say yes to a deal now that we have volume, it's going to be and usually in five states, right? I would say we're going to say no outside of these. It's going to be California, Nevada, Texas, Florida, and then it would probably be North Carolina we really like. So if it's outside of that, it's got to be like beautiful.
Really,
you know
good.
What I mean?
Yep.
Or we can consult you and we can help you out, you know, and make sure that you feel good and we can JV with you, but we would probably want some skin in the game with you because you're probably local to the area. So if you can help project manage, we'd love to be able to go in with you on that.
Nice. So fix and flippers looking for alternative avenues should be hooking up with you.
Yeah, dude. You know, we even have a couple fix and flippers. They'll buy it. And because you know how when you pull draws, you know, your interest rates are going to, I mean, it's going to go a lot higher. They just don't do draws. They just position themselves on the home. We fund the renovations privately, and then we work into the equity together. And I'm like, I love doing these with them. You know, they're in first position, super easy to work with. They just have a certain net they want to make. We'll just take everything above it. And it's a great way to be able to kind of utilize the bank and, you know, work into creative, you know, in a way that they feel comfortable doing it.
Yeah, that's great. So you already kind of answered my next question, which was the markets. I was going to go into which markets you like. Now, maybe a follow-up on that would be, why those markets? What are some of the features of those markets that make them stand out over others? So what are people looking for?
Yeah, I mean, you got to look at, you know, you got to follow the traffic. You know, they're very congested areas. You know, Orlando's not going anywhere. SoCal's not going anywhere. NorCal, you know, and so it's more predictable. You know, we just had one close in New York. I mean, I'm not saying we won't go there. It's just we have to be able to identify what we're confident in. And we also go kind of where the buy box of our investors are comfortable going. You know, so if I know we're getting continuous good returns, sometimes they're just like, hey, I want to park my money here. You know, and I totally respect that. So identifying people that would like to, you know, go over off that approach for other properties, we do have a lot of them. But I just like, you know, days on market that are going to be smaller. I like being able to take the first offer that we get. As long as I hit my minimum, you know, I don't need to try to stretch profit at all. You know, I don't care if it's $10,000 below market. If I sell this thing and we're able to hit what we were going to hit, everyone walks away happy, you know? So, and we usually are able to tend to sell these things a lot quicker, get dollars in the door in those markets because just so many people are looking for homes in those markets.
Yeah. So how do you approach the balance between leveraging debt and equity in funding your real estate projects? And then what factors that really influence this decision-making process?
Oh my God, such a good question. The debt to equity ratio that we have is not having too many deals out at one time, right? I never want to ensure that we're over leveraging. I'm never going to have more than two borrowers on a property. So I will say that we'll even stop, you know, when it comes down to equity splits, if we've identified a great one and, it's going to take $150,000, $200,000, but we're waiting for this property to close, we'll end up extending out, you know, with that homeowner until we can close escrow on this one to be able to position ourselves with good reserves to make sure that our lenders are always protected. So it's not like we just shotgun it and then we see which ones close first. We really kind of have a domino effect of like, okay, You know, where are we comfortable with? Because I always want to make sure we have enough to cover what's necessary if something were to happen, right? If our investors do tend to want to pull out, you know, they're going to get half their return and they have to allow it. They have to give us within 60 days. So we have time. But the last thing that I want is for a deal to not close or a buyer fallout and me to feel like it's the end of the world. You know, I never, ever. And if I'm doing that, we're way stretched. You know what I mean? So identifying that and being just transparent with our lenders, it's project based. You know, like we are working in a collaborative way. If these things tend to sit, you're going to get paid out at close of escrow. So I think we over communicate as well. I think that's a really big thing with our investor. And I think that people
second
don't
that.
Dude, it's so it blows my mind. They're like, yeah, it's just I'm so nervous to tell my investor, you know, that it's going to take another 30 days. I'm like, oh, when's the last time you talked to him? They're like, oh, like a month ago. I'm like, what? Like, dude, give him a call, keep him
communicate.
Updated.
Yeah,
communicate. Because when you start doing those things, we've had to extend out and they're just like, yeah, of course, you know, I totally get that. When you're open to allowing them to know that this is, they understand the risk. They get it. You know what I mean? So you need to, the moment that you hide it and then they try to find it from another third party, you've lost your credibility. You know what I mean? You've lost it and it happens all the time. Word of mouth is going to make or break you in real estate and your reputation is everything. So that's kind of a big thing for me, trickling it in, not being able to take on projects that are going to overextend us outside of our reserves. And that's usually what we end up focusing on.
Wise borrowers, listen to this man because he speaks the language of the private money lender. Okay. Because there is an underworld in the private money lending space and there are names that go through the underworld.
I bet.
There are
Dude,
names.
They won't get money
in the future.
You want to know who I thank for that? It's my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was the very first person to lend on one of my deals. And I wanted to go half with her, right? I wanted to go 30,000, she go 30. And it was like around my birthday, I think. And she was like, I trust you. I believe in you. You know what I mean? And just doing that puts you in a position of responsibility where you're like, even if I had 30,000 of my own money, whether it was lost or not, I had to take that on. I'm not going to lose her money. You know what I mean? And so identifying that, we've done 17 deals since. That's 17 deals. And we have one in Houston to make it 17. And she's always reinvested. And it's because of that. I was so like, hey, mama, this is what's going on. This is what's going on. She just told me, she goes, I love it because I felt like I was a part of that process. And I'm like, let me just do that more. You know, so we have Thursdays are always our investor Thursdays. We call every one of our investors. We update them. Same with our sellers. I mean, you're going to get sick of us. You know, you're like, you're going to hear a call. You're going to get sick. And some people do. Some people are like, hey, Trev, great. You know, tell your finance manager, I just need an email every other week. Okay. You know what I mean? But you're going to tell me that, you know what I mean? So that's kind of where I am with that.
So I love this process you've now baked in where you believe you need to have a level of reserves. I'm going to assume at the beginning you didn't have that. How'd you work up to that? And, you know, what was your process? Because I feel like that would be valuable for people who are trying to figure that out right now.
Yeah.
How did you get there?
It's going to be, I just actually had this question too from a student of mine. It's an answer you don't want to hear. You know, I didn't pull from any profit at all. I mean, it really is like live below your means. You know, I know that you've created a life. I did with wholesale, got in front of money quick. But as you start leveraging others, you know, OPMs, you start putting yourself in a position, you realize wealth building is going to be a long game. So I stopped getting my big checks. I stopped doing all that. And I was able to build up my reserves because that's where, you know, the heart of my business lies. So if I'm not doing anything correctly, all of my wealth is going to be gone. And so I just kind of stacked that up. I had great people around me, like my operations managers, my partner, Dan, my finance manager, the people that started with me kind of drank the Kool-Aid. They believed in the vision. So it was rough. And then coming into it, they always got paid. And then identifying that we're in a good position was where we could prove that. And then I felt a lot more confident being able to start asking for more. So it was like, it was, you know, the birthdays and the Christmases for, you know, a year and a half were like not there, but my wife knew too. And that's the reason why I keep going back, man. Every time I do these calls, I just always, it's just because of her. It's because of her. And so, I don't know. I think that she just gets it. You know, I didn't have to keep up with the Joneses. You know what I mean?
Yep. No, super wise. I'm very curious because I'm always thinking in terms of like when I get into you know, I don't want to do the capital raising forever. I want to be doing my own real estate gigs. And, you know, I assume I will be borrowing other people's money to get there. You know, that's the assumption.
Oh, I believe it.
But like, what kind of reserves do you keep for yourself in order to, like, you indicated that there's a point at which you might even stop doing projects because you recognize your reserves wouldn't be enough to cover a project. How do you work that? What kind of, I don't know, reserves to borrowing ratio do you keep?
I think it's always the principal amount. You know, I think we can work in when it comes down to the interest position, but if we're going to have, you know, if I'm going to have $300,000 out at a time, that's going to be spread among six projects, we're going to be able to see proof of funding for, I would say, another 15 to 20% above that. So then we would have that in our position, right? And that fluctuates, right? We have overhead, we have salaries, everything. But I would say if we're going to target a new quarter and I see where we're at, then I would say, okay, we're going to fluctuate our equity splits or equity protections. We're only, our buy box for equity splits are going to be this, this, and this, because then we know we're a green light. But if we're going to be, you know, if we're going to be maxed out, we've had four or five deals close in the quarter, we know that we can probably double our spend on that. So it really is kind of a quarter by quarter basis, but I would make sure the principal that's out, we always have the same principal to cover plus a year's worth of overhead, right? To run my business.
That is smart. A lot of borrowers would do good to hear that.
I love it, man.
I love this process. So yeah. And that is not easy. I can tell.
No.
I recognize that to get to that level is not an easy feat, but man, that's great. There's some integrity behind that too. So thank you.
Marine, baby.
I love it. Yeah. I love it.
No, thank you.
So maybe you can explain then your process. So you use a lot of private capital. What is your process for structuring a deal to ensure that the private money lender's investment is protected, even in the event of, you know, an unforeseen challenge? Obviously, you've already alluded to the personal guarantee that you've got capital to go and fund that. But what are some other things that you believe are always, you know, a part of your process? It's an ovation, so I'm not sure, you know, like what are your standard security metrics?
Man, we just hope and pray. That's good.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
you know, the thing, finding the right lender is, you know, is huge, because novations, they're seller finance, they're seller carry flips. So we're not in first position. You know, when we open up escrow, we have our intent to purchase. So a couple things behind a deal, when it comes down to that money, anything 5,000 and below, just to preface, we pay for. I don't raise money for any of our equity, our REPs. Anything really below 20 grand, we pay for the most part, but it's easier to leverage. I would say the equity split side, you know, we come into it, we have to make sure that we always have a limited power of attorney. All right. It's notarized, attorney backed. Now, we've never had to execute, you know, one on sale, but because we have our escrow open, we always have an intent to purchase. So in doing so, if we renovate the home and the seller ever says, I changed my mind, we have a disclosure signed by them, right? And then we also have, you know, a power of attorney to be able to execute the sale, which is held up already in seven states where we've had to talk to attorneys whenever it got to a position and the seller goes, yeah, you're right. And the attorney's like, yeah, you know, this is what we're doing. This was always the intent, unless you do a novation indemnification, which is just a replacement of my position to a conventional third party purchaser. So we've never had to utilize it, but a great power of attorney on it. You know, we always lean against the home. You know, we have we record a memorandum. We also do the notice of interest. So we cloud title, and all of this is given to our lender as well to identify that we've also been able to do what's necessary. And so once that's in a position, like you said, it's a personal guarantee, right? Whether it's a proof of funding to be showed or whether, you know, whatever's necessary, but we're going to be able to get that notarized and annotated as well. So we already have three positions to be able to be backed by our asset. And then if they want something else as well, we can lean, or we can also look at properties that we hold as assets, you know, ourselves, whether it's our Airbnbs, to make sure they know that we have good collateral. And it really, we probably have to do that once. But once you get the reoccurring, and you can easily stand for it, once you get, you know, that warm and fuzzy and you feel as if you get your return back once to even twice, you know, it can be on autopilot. There's a lot more trust that goes into it, right? So that due diligence is really only up front. But once you build that relationship, you know, raising capital is tough, but not keeping your sellers is, you know, it's a downhill, you know, it's a downhill slope. If you're not doing that, then you're not going to be able to continuously put yourself in the position to win. So I'm raising capital. Obviously, you know, we're in discussions. I'm always actively looking, but I'm always making sure that the first people that have access to be able to lend are people that have trusted me, you know, that we can lend in. And I want to add to that family, not take away from them.
Yeah. That's great. Cool. You also do, I think you mentioned in your PDF that you sent to me the other day.
Yeah, yeah.
I never remember the name of that thing. What is that called?
Submission form. I don't know. Yeah. It's like a summary.
Anyway. Yeah. Your summary of yourself. Anyway. But yeah, in that document, you indicated something about insurance. My clarification is that titles and also homeowners? How does that
work? It is titles. It is homeowners. It's errors and omissions, right? You have different types of insurances that's going to be able to get covered. And that is a nuanced factor in itself, right? I will say we just had a talk with our project manager in regards to it. He is a wizard behind identifying what we have in regards to that. So it is, yeah, we are able to position ourselves with that. We have the liability insurance. Obviously we have contractor's insurance. So anything that gets subs out with it, we have identified the license. We've leaned with the license. And then we of course have contractor's insurance of anybody who's going to be on the job as well. Now working into that, you know, I didn't have a team before. This is kind of, you're failing forward. You know, I'm learning all this as you end up getting into it, but it's so crazy to look back and know you were like, wow, I was not doing all that, you know, all the time, you know, until you get into a position, which is pretty cool to see. But yeah, those are different types of insurances that you have. And of course, sellers don't assume risk on any of our contracts if anything were to happen to the property. We still position ourselves to be able to buy out, even if we have to wait. If the property burns down and there's an insurance claim or whatever, we always have the intent to purchase with the homeowner at that guaranteed price. And then we have to put it in that position to get it worth where it could have been. So they're very protected. I mean, our sellers, they're very protected. And of course, out of that amount, they still pay their mortgage, right? So, I mean, they take care of, that's what they're responsible for. But anything above that, it's going to be completely at risk to us as the novator.
Nice. Cool. Well, at the very beginning, we indicated that you're looking to go and double your profits this year. And yes. So that's a pretty cool goal. What are your, you know, KPIs or metrics that your company's focusing on to track that progress towards the goal of doubling?
You know, it is community submissions. I would say we're trying to look at the educational stance, right? Seriously, as my private community grows, because that's actually something we didn't touch into. I don't do too much direct to seller marketing. A lot of our deals come from the two approaches, right? The agencies, so people who are not wanting to list properties that need work, and wholesalers who are trying to identify novations outside of their buy box of what they can move. So they funnel into my community. It's a free community. It's called Buyer Beater University. And all I do is I try to teach them the warm handoff of where their deal is and how they can position it to a creative approach. And so as I'm trying to double what my quarters are or what I want to come in front of, that means reverse engineer. Now I have to be able to double how many offers we do, which means I have to try to double, obviously, how many submissions we get from our community, which means I have to double my time giving back to the community to be able to help grow them confidently to give us more deals. So it is strictly community-based. I mean, we're doing our Zooms, we're going off warm handoff scripts, we're doing role play, we're doing on-market calls to, you know, to agents who've listed, you know, vacant properties already. And we're just all you know, trying to, you know, be collaborative as much as possible. So if I want to get in front of more deals, I got to make sure my community is a lot more confident. So last year we were coming in front of, I think it was a 24% conversion rate. We're coming in front of, I think, 20 submissions a month, right? And now we're coming in front of roughly between 30 to 40 submissions a week. So we are coming in front of it. But as you grow, it means it's always the same question. So you're continuously trying to be a well, you know, to let them understand how to get into it. And so I'm automating certain things, putting them in the best position of accountability, and setting my team up for success by allowing them to understand our approaches. So doubling my community submissions, man, so I can double my revenue for last year.
Love it. So in your community, so it's buyer beater, and how can wholesalers get into this community? Is it primarily wholesalers, or is it also agents?
Yeah, it's mainly wholesalers, agents. I would say you have some fix and flippers. It really is for anybody that wants to know novations. You know, if you want to learn novations, you want to add this to your tool belt, it's buyerbeateruniversity.com. It's free. You join, you watch all my past Zooms, you go to my actual Zooms. I have a Podio submission form, all that fun stuff. And then we go over and teach you exactly what to do. So if you jump in there, it is going to be a lot of questions from wholesalers, making sure deals work. We give you access to our novation calculator, right? You get access to understanding exactly, you get our whole top 1% list of agents that list novations. So it's a collaborative way of saying, hey, if you find something, you get access to our entire team to be able to move this to the finish line. And then we attach you to the equity on the deals.
Love it. Cool. Wow. Free community. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, man.
How often are your Zooms?
Every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific. Every Wednesday. And they're usually about in an hour. Yesterday was like 2 hours, man. It was just, we were having hot calls with some on-market properties trying to pitch equity splits. And it was a lot of fun. So it's very collaborative. It's not really a classroom environment. So if you're going to join, just get ready for me to help you, you know, do the damn thing. Cause I'm a Marine. Accountability is crucial. If you want to make money, I will make sure that you're going to make some, you know, you're going to make some money through the novation approach.
Obviously you want more community submissions. Mm-hmm. What would you say your top three things that you need more of this year? Ooh. I'm assuming one of them is private capital.
Private capital. Private capital would be amazing. The second would be community members, right? Getting in front of it. Cause I love the idea of just growing. And the third one, what would I need for that third one, man? What a good question. You know what? I would say it's kind of a two. If you're a good agent on here, or you're a good contractor and you're confident in your work, you should reach out, because if we identify that, you know, we can work together, look, I'm having to build this from scratch every market I go to. You know, that's why it takes so long to set myself up. But if you feel as if you got a good market and you have skills that could help benefit what we're talking about, I absolutely say reach out, because I guarantee you there's a way that we could work together. Where you're an on-market agent, you're a notary, you know, or, you know, you got your contractor's license, you're a painter. There's always going to be different approaches that we can utilize. So I love working with people who you know, are more mom and pop, or maybe just in a position where they're looking to grow themselves. We can really probably collaborate that way as well.
And for your markets, obviously, you know, you got a team out there in California, but for your mm-hmm. markets that are out there in, you know, North Carolina, and you know, you're not flying to all these different locations to go and manage your projects. What does it take to go and manage those projects? And yeah, go ahead.
We've had to fly a couple times, not me. My project managers had to go out to Texas a lot, in Florida or Nevada. I will say we rely on our agents a lot. So that's why we don't skimp on our agents. I mean, we give them full commissions. It's like, hey, we're going to be with you for some months because you're going to be helping us through this. And we get our weekly updates from them. They walk the property. They're subject matter experts of the area. So we lean on them heavily, and they sign an entire agreement. We have a buyer beater agreement of saying, hey, we need this from you. Here's a free listing and a beautiful home. And then let's do multiple. Because if you got one in, we're going to do our direct mailers. We're going to do our, you know, our campaigns. Whenever we find and identify, you're going to be our gal or our guy. So they get worked into, obviously, more throughout the year. And they love that. So they're kind of our eyes and ears there, right? So to answer that question, if you have someone's kind of submissive, you know, who's an old dog, new tricks, very, you know, it's, we're not going to work with you. We need somebody who we can be innovative with, who understands the investment mind, and we'll grow together. You know, we'll go from, we had somebody who did, I think, 3 deals in the area that came from the community. Now she's at 11, right? And so she doesn't care about investing. She doesn't care at all. She just wants to be an agent. Some people love the glamour and the lifestyle of the on-market play, and that's our girl. Right. And so that's over in Florida. So if you're somebody who wants that and we can scratch each other's back, there's a lot of business we could do.
Love it. In closing, do you have any words of wisdom or warning for those who are considering exiting their 9-to-5? Would love to go and do that. Right. Those are some of my listeners. So words of warning or wisdom.
You know, I do. I have something that's my mantra, something I always say to my team is imperfect action is better than perfect non-action. you know, I do think that you're over here listening to this, you know, and then you're going to take a bunch of notes and you're going to wait for Justin to drop another great podcast. But in doing so, you know, you're waiting to fit this perfect plan. It's not going to happen. You know, perfect inaction is what's going to make you fail forward. I didn't know what I was doing. Justin didn't know what he was doing, but you believed in yourself to position yourself to be able to start doing the damn thing. So if you have a 10-year game plan, but you're not taking step one, you know, unfortunately, you're not doing anybody a service. So imperfect action, better than perfect non-action.
Yeah. Keep driving forward.
I love it. Yeah. That's a big one for me.
It's got to start somewhere, right? And it's probably going to be kind of messy at first. I can tell you from my own experience, it's messy. You want to know what I do every day? I go and wake up every day and do the W-2, and then I put the W-2 computer away, and I come home and I open up the business computer.
I love that.
Until, you know, 7-8 o'clock at night, spend some time with the family, go to bed, get up, exercise, and do it all over again.
Boom. Sounds like a damn good day, man. I'm telling you right now, you know, and you got to want that. That's another thing. You really got to want that.
And you got to see the vision beyond the here and the now. The here and the now is going to have to be ugly.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. And, you know, I'm blessed, but coming into it, I did the same thing in the Marine Corps. I mean, it's a passion, you know, and they always say it. What's that saying? That's like, you know, if you love what you do, you're not working a day in your life. But it really is. If you want to involve that in your everyday, I mean, you really got to, you know, you got to be able to love the grind. You know, like when the Marine Corps, you got to fall in love with being in the suck. You know what I mean? So I'm a big fan of that. Becoming comfortable when you're uncomfortable is huge. And you shouldn't know everything. Make your calls and suck, and then suck more, and then suck even harder. And then you're going to get somebody that actually wants to talk to you. And you got to like that. Like, you got to want to do that. You know what I mean? So it's not as hard as you think. You know, I would just say consistency over anything is crucial.
Absolutely. Trevor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Justin, I appreciate the time, man. Your platform's amazing.
Awesome. As we wrap up, remember that opportunities are often right in front of us, waiting to be discovered. Trevor's journey from military to real estate success is absolutely a testament to this. His innovative approach to innovations shows that with just a little bit of creativity, even dead deals can turn profitable. And as we navigate the possibilities for wealth building and entrepreneurship, it's crucial to recognize the value of investing in yourself and continually seeking knowledge. Your journey is unique, and persistence is key to achieving success. Be sure to tune in for more enriching conversations on future episodes of Nursing Real Wealth. Have a great day. God bless.